Okay, we're calling the Health and Human Service Policy Committee to order. We have the minutes before us. Can I have someone to move the minutes for Wednesday, February the 19th?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Freiberg moves the minutes for Wednesday, February the 19th. Tuesday, February the 18th, 2020. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes moved for February the 18th, 2020. So first on our agenda would be Commissioner Jan Malcolm from the Department of Health.
Good afternoon,
Welcome to
Madam
the committee,
Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share a bit of an update on goings-on at the Health Department and a preview of some of the issues we'll be working on together this session. I've got a lot of subjects to cover, so I'm going to go pretty quickly. Hopefully you have copies of the slides, and we're always very happy to follow up with you on a deeper dive on anything that I'm skimming over today. As you know, our mission at the Health Department is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. We like to underline the word all, as we've known for many, many years that we're among the healthiest states in the nation on average, but beneath those averages, we have a lot of very significant disparities and inequities in health risks and health outcomes for populations of color, Native Americans, folks in rural Minnesota, folks lower on the socioeconomic scale, but that is just an overarching key principle of ours, is that our job is to work toward a state of health equity where every person in every community really has what they need to live their lives of optimal health. This next picture is something that you've seen from me before, just a reminder that what we know about what really determines health outcomes has been emerging and just incredibly rich data emerging in our own country and internationally about the things that really are the biggest levers for improving health at the population level. We used to really focus almost exclusively on clinical care. Not that that's unimportant. It is absolutely necessary but not sufficient to improve population health. In fact, it only accounts for about 10% of the difference in health outcomes for populations when controlling for all other factors. We then spent many, many years, and still do, of course, focusing on individual health behaviors, the choices that we all make and need to make to live our healthiest lives. But now we know more and more that people don't make those choices in a vacuum. The choices they have available to them are, of course, profoundly shaped by conditions in the community, physical conditions in the community, how the community is literally built and constructed, and social and economic factors at the community level as well. So I share this with you again just because it's such an important context for understanding what it really takes to move the needle on health status for Minnesotans or to close health equity gaps, that it's not only a matter of access to care, but those other tools are available and necessary for us to consider as well. Just a quick reminder of some of the key kind of distinctions in operations and focus between the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. We share these committees, and oftentimes the partners with whom we work in the community and sometimes legislators aren't entirely clear about who does what between DHS and MDH. This is an extremely simplified picture, of course, but when you're looking at the health care parts of the DHS portfolio of services, they're really focused for the most part on treatment, whereas in public health, we're focused primarily on prevention, although certainly we do some direct services and DHS does some prevention. But if you just look at these examples, DHS's programs are, for instance, aimed at getting medical treatment to the population, or in this example, to children with measles. Whereas MDH's role really is to work at the population level to encourage vaccination, to work with parents, schools, providers about increasing awareness of the importance and the value of immunizations. DHS's focus when it comes to chronic disease is making sure people have coverage for the treatment of those chronic diseases. And our work in public health is really working with communities, including certainly local governments and local public health, to reduce the prevalence of those chronic diseases to begin with. DHS obviously does a great deal of work to make treatment available for people with addiction or overdoses in various treatment programs in provider settings and elsewhere, whereas MDH's role is really to try to go further upstream to understand what are the root causes of a whole cluster of conditions that we see tied to overdose, including alcohol abuse, opioids, suicide, etc. So again, a pretty simplified contrast there, but just critical to know that this is a very close partnership, and we are in some ways two sides of the coin in terms of prevention and treatment. The next slide you also have seen before, just reminding us that I think one of the challenges is that we that the resource distribution at the national level and here in Minnesota across kind of the intervention side of healthcare versus the prevention side of public health is a pretty dramatic difference in resources allocated to those functions. At the national level, the estimate is that no more than 5% of entire spending nationally on anything to do with health and medical care is based on population health prevention. 95% is really through the medical care delivery system itself, which certainly does include some prevention activities and early detection activities at the individual patient level. But still, especially when you look at that picture that we looked at a minute ago about all the factors that influence the outcomes when it comes to health status in our populations, we see some challenges here with the investment portfolio, if you will. And in Minnesota, this is just a picture of the Health and Human Services state budget, 98% of which is DHS and the other medical boards that roll up to the Health and Human Services budget category, and about 2% to MDH. Small but mighty, we like to think. But this is really a challenge when you look at the projections for health spending in our state. These data come from a report that we did last year at the Health Department, and we do periodically spending reports that look in great detail at where we're spending the money and what the projections are for the future. And we know from these data that we just can't afford to just treat our way out of these health challenges. We know we've seen the ballooning rates of health spending, and we know what's in the pipeline now is very much driven by chronic conditions. I just heard a presentation a week or so ago from a health economist saying that 90% of all healthcare spending starts with at least one chronic condition. So that chronic condition may bring with it other acute episodes, but that chronic conditions really are the source of the great majority of our nation's and state's healthcare spending. And we can see the trend lines, given the aging of the population, given the health risk factors that we know are in some cases growing rather than reducing, including unhealthy weight and lack of physical activity. We can see the projections for chronic condition spending among the elderly population, dementia, hypertension, just as some examples, just to kind of underscore the point that we've got such spending pressures in healthcare now, and what we can anticipate in the future, unless we can find a way to better intervene in the prevalence of health risks and the prevalence of chronic conditions, will be an ever increasing budget challenge. The next few slides just kind of reorient you to how the health department is organized. We have four bureaus, as we call them, kind of the major groupings of activities within the health department. So within the Health Operations Bureau, which is headed by our Deputy Commissioner Margaret Kelly, is our Financial Management Division, Human Resources and Facilities Management, and IT, as well as things like internal audit building. A big priority for us is to build a culture of performance measurement and performance improvement. In the Health Protection Bureau, led by Assistant Commissioner Dan Huff, it resides the Environmental Health Division, which works hard on clean air, water, and Soil in partnership with many other state agencies and to look at the environmental risks to human health, the Public Health Laboratory, and the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division. So things that have been really central to the public health mission for hundreds of years, where the greatest threats to human health once resided in these infectious disease and environmental health issues, and still, of course, a major part of the public health mission. The Health Improvement Bureau, headed by Acting Assistant Commissioner Deb Burns, consists of three large divisions: the Child and Family Health Division, which includes all our maternal and child health programs, including WIC, supplemental nutrition, family home visiting, and the like. The Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division, which is where our chronic disease epidemiology, all the data analyses that go into understanding what are the trends and the rates of chronic disease in Minnesota. This group works closely with provider community on establishing kind of statewide plans around long-range goals for prevention and management of some of these chronic diseases. Cancer screening program and injury and violence section is also in this division. In the Community Health Division is where we have our interface with our local public health agencies around the state, also where we have the Office of Statewide Health Improvement, which runs the Statewide Health Improvement Program, or SHIP, division of a unit of around health statistics, and also our Center for Health Equity are in the Community Health Division. So that's the Health Improvement Bureau. The Health Systems Bureau, led by Assistant Commissioner Marie Dotseth, is where the Health Policy Division resides. I think you're familiar with our work in health economics, our Office of Rural Health, our Managed Care section, are all part of the Health Policy Division. The Office of Medical Cannabis also resides within the Health Systems Bureau, as does the Health Regulation Division, which is a very large and complicated division that oversees the regulation of 40 different provider types and health facility types. So it's a very large and complex division. I want to spend just a minute describing to you some work that I'm particularly proud of that is aimed at modernizing the Health Regulation Division, or HRD as we abbreviate it. And this was really inspired by the tough lessons learned and the hard work on process improvements that have happened over the last few years in our Office of Health Facility Complaints, where we process reports and complaints submitted by facilities and also by individual consumers and concerned persons on behalf of consumers who are alleging maltreatment in a healthcare facility. That very well publicized, and we have spent a lot of time with members of the legislature unpacking and repairing that function. But we didn't want to stop there. We really wanted to take to heart the process improvement lessons that we had learned and challenge ourselves to think about how some of those lessons could be applied more broadly across the way we regulate health providers and health facilities. So starting early last year, this particular division has undertaken a really big redesign effort, taking a look at how we might modernize the way we approach regulation of facilities and providers. This division has been built up over literally decades around individual programs created by the legislature over time to regulate a certain type of provider or a certain type of care setting. But what we kind of did over that length of time was build up seven different programs that were pretty siloed and pretty self-contained. So what we've done now, though, is to take a look at what are the common functionalities across those programs and to plan for a reorganization along functional lines rather than just building separate silos for separate types of providers or separate types of care settings, so that we would be able to be much more efficient and also produce work of higher quality, more nimbly, be better positioned for policy changes coming from the legislature, including implementing the very significant assisted living licensure law, which you supported last year. We knew from the work that the Office of the Legislative Auditor had done, you may remember this, did a really thorough review of how the problems had emerged in the Office of Health Facility Complaints over time. So taking to heart a lot of those lessons about our management systems, our culture, employee morale, just to try to redesign the whole division through the lens of making improvements in those areas. And so this is a picture that probably won't mean a great deal to you because it's not in contrast to anything. But today's chart, you would see different programs built around different provider types and facility types. This is a functional design that really tries to pull out the similar functionality across all of those programs so that we are able to support those functions more nimbly and to a deeper level of expertise. One really key point here is to really, to a much greater degree, regionalize our operations so that the folks doing these regulatory functions are closer to the facilities and the people of Minnesota that they're serving around the state. And really building out some of those functions in common that the different programs have had. So this is a pretty inside baseball, but I just wanted to share with you the fact that we are trying to take the lessons learned very much to heart and using it to do a pretty significant redesign of this function, which I think will serve the state better and allow us to use our resources much more efficiently going forward. We do believe that this is going to have lots of benefits to quality as well as to workforce satisfaction and retention and morale. And lots of efficiency gains here as well. Happy to share more detail with you as that emerges. So that a lot of the planning happened last year. We're beginning implementation. This will take a couple of years, several years, before this redesigned approach to health regulation is fully in place. But happy to share progress with you and some of the successes that I anticipate will come out of this redesign over time. Just a quick update on the assisted living licensure process. A part of why we undertook this redesign was we didn't think that that it would be smart to stand up a whole new, yet another eighth major silo in the division. To build de novo, all the regulations and the enforcement capability around this new assisted living licensure. So the redesign is enabling us to approach this implementation of assisted living licensure in a more nimble way as well. You might remember, and we are so grateful for the bipartisan and bicameral support for passing this bill last year. The assisted living licensure law fully takes effect on August 1st of 2021, so that any facility holding itself out as an assisted living facility needs to be licensed as such by that date. Some parts of the law have already taken effect. An enhanced home care bill of rights took effect on August 1st last summer. The electronic monitoring part of the law, which I know the legislature spent a long time discussing over a couple of different sessions, took effect January 1st. We worked in partnership with the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care to get that in place. And from all reports, it's gone quite well. And we are not seeing a lot of difficulties with the implementation of that electronic monitoring provision. We're continuing to work hard with the stakeholders who came together to make it possible to produce a really substantive policy improvement. We're on an extremely aggressive timeline for implementation of the law. The rules that are necessary to implement the statute need to be adopted by December 31st of this year in order for the providers to have time to really get ready for pursuing a new license by August 1st. So we're working really hard to develop the rules. We expect to have a draft of those rules by the end of April of this year, and that really is we're well served by continuing a close collaborative consultative relationship with all of the stakeholders on the rule development. There will be, I believe, a very focused list of technical amendments and priority topics that need to be resolved for the rules to be finalized during this session. So we'll be getting that language to you very, very soon. It will be a very focused list. We know implementing a complex bill such as this, we're going to be learning a lot of things as we implement it, and I know we will be back in future years to talk about refinements to the statute itself. But this year's discussion will be very, very focused on just those immediate issues that need resolution in order for this timeline to keep moving. So moving now into the rest of the policy agenda for the department. So that short list of fixes needed for the assisted living licensure law will be on the list. Also, we have a number of things in the arena of protecting our youth from the ongoing hazards of tobacco and the emerging epidemic that we've all watched over, with increasing alarm of e-cigarette use or vaping. So we will be bringing forward proposals to codify Tobacco 21 statewide and to apply that to all forms of tobacco and nicotine, including e-cigarettes, as well as a flavor ban on tobacco and nicotine products, again, including both traditional cigarettes and vaping, to include menthol and mint as flavors. And the final thing here would be to allow the governor to have some emergency powers to act when the legislature's not in session on rapidly emerging public health threats. As the vaping epidemic and the severe lung injury crisis that was unfolding during the interim, the governor was frustrated to learn that whereas other governors could do immediate flavor bans or restrictions on vaping, he did not have that authority. So we'll be looking at some targeted language to make it clear that the governor has authority to act in certain situations. There will also be a couple of proposals related to drinking water protection. One allowing the Public Financing Authority to create a funding program for replacement of lead and water service lines on private property, which today it's only public property, and a Groundwater Protection Act modification to allow the Health Department to use scientific risk analyses in addition to and beyond those published by the U.S. EPA, which will allow us to move faster and use rapidly evolving science for our own water protection activities. A couple of other topics under the rubric of consumer protection. We have language to protect consumers from balance billing, otherwise known as surprise billing, particularly in the arena of emergency services and out-of-network services for emergencies. Also, closing what we think is a bit of a loophole that in last year's language, 2019, there were some increased transparency standards applied to nonprofit HMOs in Minnesota around the transparency of their financial transactions kind of within their corporate structures. However, we didn't apply that to for-profit HMOs, which are now allowed in Minnesota, and we do have a couple of entities already being licensed as for-profit HMOs. So we think that financial transparency should apply there as well. A couple of just really technical things. We have a number of advisory committees or councils who are in need either of extension by the legislature. In the case of the second one, the Drinking Water Wastewater Operator Advisory Council was sunset, and we I think ran out of time last year to get that fixed. Also, we need to extend the eHealth Advisory Committee, whose work is not yet done. We'd like to expand some membership on the Rural Health Advisory Committee. And the Health Equity and Advisory Leadership Council, or HEAL, as we call it, has been enormously helpful to the department, but it has been just an ad hoc committee, and we would like to codify that in statute, as is the case for a similar advisory group at DHS. So those are pretty straightforward, would be very, very helpful to us to deal with those this year. In addition, Madam Chair, there are these four proposals that are carryovers from the last session. They have already been introduced. So you see them there, renovation and lead hazard reduction, a tweak to the chronic conditions report, which we are required to do. To make that a less frequent report so that it is both more cost-effective and more useful. and one securing access to birth and death records, and the fourth, empowering the cancer reporting system to be able to better share data with federal officials, coming into compliance with federal standards, and allowing us to be able to better use that data for purposes of trend analysis and so forth. So those are, that's just a quick preview of the agenda forthcoming from the Health Department this session. We can pause there, Madam Chair, if you'd like, or I can finish with some other updates.
Why don't you just complete your presentation, and just want to state that we have bills that do not have any chief authors, so if there's anyone who wants to be a chief author, consider it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll continue. You asked for a little update on what became a complex and topic of great public interest this summer. Around Water Gremlin, a manufacturer of lead products here in St. Paul. The Health Department had been working with St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health over the last couple of years to address what we knew were some lead hazards at that plant from take-home lead from the Water Gremlin facility. And take-home lead is lead dust that is carried out of the facility on workers' bodies, clothing, personal items, due to really not adequate worker hygiene practices. The lead dust can and does build up in workers' vehicles and homes, exposing family members and the public to lead hazards. So, as I mentioned, there had been some elevated cases of blood lead levels noted by Ramsey County. In the late fall, there was a second case of a Water Gremlin worker's child who tested, had an elevated blood lead level of over 15 micrograms per deciliter of blood. That's the level at which a follow-up investigation is required by public health. The way the blood lead level testing works is, this is part of pediatric exams and child care standards. So these blood lead level tests are reported to the department. We flag cases of elevated lead levels, but it isn't until 15 micrograms per deciliter that follow-up investigation is triggered under current standards. So when that second case was discovered, and Ramsey County conclusively determined that the cause was take-home lead from the plant and not something else like lead paint in the home, that really triggered an elevated level of concern from us. We consulted with the Department of Labor and Industries OSHA program. They then, because of our concern, the OSHA program did an inspection of the facility and found just all kinds of concerns that they had with the adequacy or inadequacy of the protections in the plant to protect workers as well as family members and the public. So based on that, the Department of Labor and Industry used its authority to issue a 72-hour shutdown order to Water Gremlin. We then concurrently, jointly filed between the Health Department and the Labor and Industry, a joint injunction with Ramsey County District Court to extend that shutdown beyond the original 72-hour period that was under Labor and Industry's standing authority. Through that court hearing process, Water Gremlin was eventually allowed to restart operations by the court, but was ordered by the court to undertake a set of fixes to prevent take-home lead on workers, including the cleaning of over 300 worker vehicles to remove lead dust. So we continue to monitor the court-ordered improvements that have been made, and more and more systemic improvements are scheduled to be made by Water Gremlin over time. What was put in place immediately was really short-term remediation, but the longer-term fixes really are modifications to the plant itself. So the temporary measures, we would agree, have generally been helpful, have reduced the amount of take-home lead leaving the plant, but are not adequate to solve the problem long-term. And those actions are also in planning and in process. We have sent letters to over 900 current and former Water Gremlin employees, notifying them of the possibility that they've been exposed to take-home lead and what they can do about it, and encouraging them to get blood lead testing and to sign up for the testing and for free cleanup of lead dust in their homes. Water Gremlin has appealed that part of the judge's decision, and so that we're still in dialogue about this, and that's a matter about the in-home testing and cleanup to be paid by Water Gremlin will be heard by the Court of Appeals in early March. To date, there have been 24 confirmed or probable cases of lead poisoning in the children of Water Gremlin employees as a result of this outreach and encouragement for employees to have their children tested for lead. And what this has done for us, there are some the heroes of the story in my mind here. We certainly, the health department staff have worked very hard, and then our partnership with labor and industry was frankly unprecedented in terms of the collaboration across the agencies and the speed of action. But it was really Ramsey County Public Health that had been doing above and beyond, and had been actually following up on their own kind of authority and their own resources. Ramsey County has been following up on all blood level tests over 5 micrograms per deciliter, which, as we now know, as the science has emerged, lower and lower levels of lead have been determined and found to be of real concern, especially in children. So we are putting forward a proposal to drop our standard for when follow-up investigations are done on the blood level tests that are reported to us down to 5 micrograms per deciliter, really following Ramsey County's lead. I think Hennepin, either Hennepin or Minneapolis, does this as well. But that's sort of discretionary at their level and on their own dime, so to speak. So we think that's the appropriate standard for better, for taking learning this lesson from Water Gremlin to be able to intervene earlier on at much lower levels of lead exposure. So that's just a quick update on Water Gremlin. Work in progress, but it is prompting us to really take a more proactive and aggressive stance in our investigation efforts. Next, I want to give you just a really quick update on the novel coronavirus that emerged in China, now known as COVID-19. You're probably following this daily in the news. There are now globally over 75,000 cases and about 2,000 deaths. Those numbers change multiple times a day. The vast, vast majority of the cases and deaths have been in mainland China. There have been cases reported now in 25 countries, including here in the U.S. We are still at 15 confirmed cases of COVID-19 total in the U.S., none confirmed in Minnesota as of this point. We do expect these numbers will increase, including from that most unfortunate cruise ship that is now being evacuated. There are U.S. passengers on that ship. I think there are some Minnesotans on that ship. So we will see, and there are over 600 cases now of confirmed COVID-19 cases on that ship. So these numbers will change. We know something about this virus just based on the other viruses in the coronavirus family and where this virus seems to be similar to some of those known agents. But we always, when something is a novel virus, never before been seen, therefore no really human immunity to it, of course it triggers a higher level of public question and concern. And we need to always say we don't know what we don't know. The thing about viruses is that they can change rather quickly, and you can learn something new a week from now that you didn't know this week. So we have to always put that in context. But as is true with other respiratory illnesses, those kind of experiencing the greatest risk from COVID-19 are older adults and those with underlying health conditions, just as we see with many respiratory illnesses. Again, no confirmed cases in Minnesota. We have had some potential cases with folks from China who had been in Wuhan during the period of when this virus was really breaking out of the animal market in Wuhan. So we did have some potential cases here, but none have been found to be confirmed on laboratory testing from the CDC. At the present, only CDC has been doing the laboratory testing to determine whether something is COVID-19 based on the genetics of this specific virus. CDC did amazing work to develop a lab test really very quickly. They are in the process of getting that capacity to do laboratory confirmation out to select state health department laboratories, public health labs, including ours. So we expect to be in a position to be doing some of this testing here in Minnesota within coming days or weeks. So what we've been doing is a lot of communicating, really literally daily communications with the healthcare systems around the state, local public health, community groups, particularly groups, Chinese Minnesota connection groups, lots of conversation with the University of Minnesota and the other schools of higher ed who may have students and faculty from China. As well, we're getting increasing requests for help from K-12 teachers and administrators who want to just know if we develop cases in Minnesota, what should they be doing? What is the same, what is different in terms of appropriate protections and response. We do get a lot of calls still every day from Minnesotans who are concerned about, you know, their recent travel, not necessarily to China, but just travel anywhere. And of course, they're concerned, they're reading about the respiratory symptoms of COVID-19, which are almost indistinguishable from regular seasonal flu or cold, you know, without laboratory confirmation. So we are responding to lots of calls from providers and the public. You're probably aware of the measures that had put in place at the federal level, restricting air travel from China at all, or for Americans coming back from China, being directed to 11 screening airports. Those who are from Hubei, whether they have any symptoms or not, are transported to designated quarantine locations for 14 days. And travelers from other locations in China are asked to self-quarantine for 14 days. And we at the state level are given information daily from the CDC and Homeland Security about any travelers coming back to Minnesota in that situation. So indeed, we do have some Minnesotans who have been part of this kind of travel monitoring program that we are in touch with and monitoring here in Minnesota. They get information on what they are to look for, take their temperature a couple of times a day, and stay in regular contact with MDH. So we are in touch with those folks. So the protective recommendations for the public really are very much the same as our recommendations for seasonal flu and other respiratory illnesses. It's the basics really pertain here just as well as to the flu. And that is, you know, to try to avoid spreading illnesses to friends and colleagues and others, to stay home when you're sick. Cover your cough with a tissue or your elbow or coughing into a garment, not into your hands. That is the quickest way to spread these viruses, and to wash your hands well, thoroughly, and often. We are not recommending at this time that anybody needs to cancel any community events. We've had that question from a number of different sources. There is no virus circulating in our community at this time, so there's no need for people to think that they are not safe to go about their normal business. we certainly will continue to monitor the situation and make any changes in that advice as we get more information or as numbers, if numbers were to change significantly in the U.S. or here in Minnesota. We have had some question about face masks. The CDC's advice is that face masks really only need to be used by ill people to prevent the spread of infection, or by healthcare workers that are directly providing care to ill people. And the CDC does not recommend that the general public needs to be using face masks as just a general protective measure at this point. And we do we hear some, you know, some rumors of desires to stockpile protective equipment in case it is needed later. But we do want to make sure that we have enough supply of personal protective equipment to make sure that those who truly need it get it first. So just a reassurance that we don't all need to be stockpiling masks. Influenza. Wanted to just put this in context for you too, both because it's a very important, a critical health issue in Minnesota and around the country every year, but it also helps to kind of put the COVID-19 discussion into context. We are continuing to see elevated influenza activity in Minnesota with both influenza A and B viruses co-circulating at the same time. This year's season was a little different. It started a little earlier, and it started with influenza B, which usually doesn't show up until later in the season. So we're now having a second wave of these viruses. So far in Minnesota this season, and this was as of yesterday, these numbers, 54 deaths from the flu in Minnesota, including two pediatric deaths, over 2,200 hospitalizations, median age of 56 years, over 700 outbreaks of influenza-like illness in our grade schools and high schools, K-12, over 50 outbreaks of influenza in long-term care facilities. This is a real and present risk to public health, and it's very important that we continue to be vigilant about this, both in terms of individual protections, but also working with these facilities to help them respond when they are having a localized outbreak. And the percentage of flu tests that are positive is still elevated beyond what you'd see if the flu season was beginning to taper off at about 36 or 37%. So that's just kind of, again, for reference, for context, for Minnesotans, understandable that we all are interested in coronavirus because it's new and it's unknown, but the annual known toll of flu is still very much with us. And it could well be that what we see with coronavirus is that this COVID-19 will become a circulating strain of coronavirus that's just with us in the future and becomes another of the annual coronaviruses to manage going forward. That is a possibility. It so far seems like it is, and again, giant caveat of what we don't know, so far seems like COVID-19 is less severe than MERS and about the same as SARS, the two of the prior coronavirus outbreaks that we've managed globally. And a little bit more severe than seasonal flu, but the numbers are still fast evolving in terms of what is the case fatality rate compared to the total number of coronavirus cases. As that you see those numbers going up and up and up in China, partly including as the Chinese officials begin to count cases that aren't just hospitalized, but cases in the community, which is what we are using as the case definition, does not require hospitalization. So that, I just covered a whole range of things there, Madam Chair, so happy to take your questions.
So thank you so much for that information and update. It was a lot of information. So we have a couple of members who like to ask you a question. I want to ask you a question first around the public health in Minnesota. You talk about dementia-related spending and the cost of going up, we cannot spend our way out of this. We got to do some more preventative work and go upstream. But I want to ask you about dementia because you have age 18 plus. And I always see that as an elder issue. Elders in quotes, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I meant to catch that when I was reviewing the slides earlier, too. I don't know why the definition is 18 plus, because certainly it is not at all a typical condition. I mean, certainly there is early onset dementia for people, you know, in decades much younger than the 70, 80, 90 year olds that we think of.
We have not yet gotten to 18.
No. Right.
All right, thank you. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, Commissioner Malcolm, thank you so much for your presentation and hitting the water gremlin issue. I want to say a large thank you to your agency and also to Ramsey County Public Health for putting a lot of hours into this. I know that a lot of work was done in Ramsey County. That was all done on the taxpayer's dime. I know the same thing with your agency. And it actually started before the lead issues for your agency. It was starting back in January when the release of TC occurred that covered a large area. And I know that you've had a lot of staff that have been attending meetings up in that area on a very every other week basis. One of the questions I have and I know you don't have the answer today, but I'd like to know, is eventually, I know that there was a lot of manpower that was taken up by the efforts up there. It'd be nice to know what those, you know, how much that ended up being. Because I know that was, as we were having some of our meetings, we were hearing that was starting to draw from other efforts that the agency was trying to address. Another thing I also want to pass out to you and the other agencies that were involved is some of the unprecedented work that had happened with working with communities who had a lot of language barriers in trying to inform them what happened with the lead issue. I know that between your department, Department of Labor, and the MPCA, that there were a lot of joint things that were done up in Ramsey County to help educate people. And one of the things I heard from the Ramsey County people that impressed them is that there were a lot of things that were coming up that really weren't covered by current statute, current law, current rules. And what I was hearing repeatedly is the efforts by your agencies to figure out how to get to yes to address the concerns by the people that were out there. So I want to say thank you for those kind of efforts that were occurring, because they were very important, particularly in communities of color, immigrant communities who are already suspicious of government to start with. So I want to say thank you for those efforts that were happening up there. I do have a couple of questions. First, in terms of the children, you mentioned that 24 children had tested positive. What percentage of that was of all children that were tested? Do you know that right offhand?
I don't. I'm just going to do a quick check and see if my colleagues might know that. Do you have any idea? I'm sorry, we don't have a good denominator right in our minds, but I will follow up with you on
that.
If
you could, I would appreciate that. Thank you. And the other thing that I was kind of wondering is, particularly with the youth who've got the elevated lead levels, is there going to be any kind of work on a long-term basis to see what ends up happening to them in terms of services, et cetera, going forward?
Commissioner Mathew.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Fisher, that's a great question. And I think that is certainly one of the things that we hope and intend to do now with this larger database that we've got about the current and past workforce. And you mentioned correctly that this is an employer of lots of new immigrant labor, and they've had it's made it challenging to communicate and to really encourage those folks to get tested, so that the follow-up with these employees is an ongoing effort. It's going to take us a long time to be able to get successfully connect with each of those families and to build the ability to, you know, to look longer term at what some of the experiences of those families are.
All right, Representative.
All right, thank you. I do know that there was some frustrations along the line with your agencies trying to deal with the contamination efforts, because there weren't very clear ways for the agencies to deal with the situation where an employer's mishandling of lead would poison somebody else in a private environment, and trying to get that environment then cleaned up afterwards. And I want to say thank you to your staff who've been working with Representative Wozlik and myself to figure out how do we close those loopholes that are occurring out there. So that is an important part of it. And then one final thing that I wanted to kind of touch on a little bit was the fact is you're dealing with a lot of immigrant people coming in where it wasn't a first language. And I know that trying to figure out the ways into the communities have been a barrier. What were some of the takeaways that you folks have learned that you can use in similar situations going forward with working with so many different people where English is not their first language?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, thanks. And I should also mention that the Department of Employment and Economic Development was another tremendous partner in being on site in Ramsey County to provide assistance, especially when it was unclear how long the plant was going to be shut down. And that was, I know, of great concern to the judge as well as to us that that needed to be. There really needed to be extraordinary resources extended to that community. In terms of any sort of lessons learned about language preparation, I think I know that it was done really quickly, and I would just see if my colleague Assistant Commissioner Huff has any comments on that part of the process.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Daniel Huff. I am Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you. Can you respond?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that what we've learned is the best thing is to have pre-existing relationships. And if we do not have relationships, then to work with our community partners who do have relationships. And so in this case, working with the Hmong American Partnership, the Karen Organization of America is very important. These organizations have those relationships. They're embedded in the community and for us to work directly with them. We translate our materials always into what the appropriate languages are, but there's nothing that beats those pre-existing relationships. And so I would say either have those ourselves, and we do have staff that we are able to involve in this that have those relationships, but then to work with community-based organizations.
Thank you.
All right, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. That was very enlightening, and I, when we talk about things like this new COVID-19 virus, it makes me really glad that we have the sort of robust health infrastructure, public health infrastructure that we do have in Minnesota. And actually, you answered some of my, I was going to ask you about how this compares to other viruses, which you answered. But just one thing I don't really hear too much in the media coverage, the fatalities that occur, am I correct in thinking that that's mostly due to pneumonia? You just don't, kind of as you would see for some of those other viruses?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm asking Dr. Ruth Linfield, our state epidemiologist, to come to the table to help me with any clinical questions you might have. And I just a quick acknowledgement, though, of your point, Representative Liebling, and you're so right. I mean, a part of this is just a good example of the surveillance system that we have continually in place in Minnesota. That's really a very strong partnership between public health and the healthcare system. Our infectious disease reporting laws serve us very well, and the relationships that we have with providers all around the state. We've done a lot of work with the Minnesota Hospital Association these past weeks so that providers know what to report and where to report it, that we are As our infectious disease staff tell us, they're on any given day, they're tracking down 10 or 12, potential things, whether it's foodborne or infectious. But so this is our daily work, and it's often very invisible. But when something like this comes along, you're absolutely right. It is very reassuring that we don't have to build these things from scratch. It's what we do. And in terms of the fatalities, perhaps Dr. Linfield could answer that, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Dr. Ruth Linfield. I am the state epidemiologist and medical director at the Minnesota Department of Health. And thank you, Madam Chair. So we don't have a lot of information other than numbers on the fatalities, and those numbers may or may not be correct. I will say a number of things. What we do know is that it is a respiratory infection. Many of the people with severe disease do have pneumonia. Some of them, in addition to having viral pneumonia and lung damage from the virus itself, may have a bacterial infection in addition. They're at risk for getting that on top of their viral pneumonia. Many of them have underlying conditions, and we do think that when they get this infection, the severe disease, it may make their underlying conditions worse. And then we do know that some of the individuals have gone on to actually develop heart damage or kidney damage in association with this virus.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just really quickly too, and Commissioner, thank you. Thank you very much for that answer. It also, sometimes we have debates in this body about health coverage, particularly, let me be quite frank, around people who may be undocumented and whether we should, you know, we have this in different contexts. And just sometimes, you know, when we think about these kinds of public health issues, I think it really points out the importance of making sure that everyone who lives among us has access to health care. Right? Not that any particular person or group is going to create a problem for the rest, but anybody can get the flu. Anybody can get a virus. Anybody. And if we don't have this kind of access to care, at least urgent kinds of care, if people can't afford care, just don't, you know, have to keep going to work because they can't afford even to stay home when they're sick with the flu or, God help us, coronavirus or something else, it puts us all in danger. So I just kind of wanted to put a point on that, how important universal access to health care is. I know the commissioner always is making the point about public health as opposed to health care, but in this case, they really come together, and it's just so important that we keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want, I don't have any other names on the list to speak. We have one other bill that we need to get to. So I just want to thank you so much for the work that you do for the people of Minnesota across the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. So House File 2898, Representative Edelson. Okay, Representative Edelson, would you like to move your bill?
Chair Moran, yes, I would. I have a delete all amendments. It's the A20.
Representative, before you do that, let's move your bill. So Representative Edelson would like to move House File 2898. So I do understand. We all have the bill before the committee. Okay. So I do understand that you have a pair of amendments to get the bill in the shape that you would like it. Should I go to the amendment?
Very good. Yes. I would like to move the A20, delete all amendments, and then incorporate the A1 amendments. Just a few technical changes.
All right. Thank you so much. So all in favor say aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Addison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2898 is a culmination of nearly 3 years of work by a large group of stakeholders organized by NAMI Minnesota. It included advocacy organizations, police, sheriffs, hospitals, county attorneys, counties, DHS staff, community providers, psychiatrists, psychologists, and a person with a mental illness, and a family member. It operated by consensus, so even if one person objected to a change, it was not included. This is to make clear that there were other changes that various groups wanted, but we wanted a bill that everyone could live with. The goal was to update the language, reflect that people are generally committed or provisionally discharged to the community, and to provide early voluntary engagement. We work to make sure people can receive the best medication to treat their illness, that missing paperwork doesn't lead to a commitment going away, and that mental health professionals have a larger role to play under this act. There are a couple of things this bill does not do. It does not change the current commitment standard. So it does not make it easier or harder to commit someone. We don't make any changes to what records are public and not public. There have been recent articles about the Baker Act in Florida. We do not commit young children in Minnesota. Parents consent to treatments in our state up to age 16, but it rarely happens at 16 and 17. I'm going to have several of the people who worked on this bill walk you through the changes. Please note that many of the changes are non-substantive. They are simply changing outdated terms, but it makes the bill much larger. I would urge your support for this consensus large bill.
Yes, and because it is such a large bill, please try to go through it as quickly as you possibly can, but slowly enough that we can understand what the changes are. Because I would like to also allow members to have questions, to ask questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you,
so
Madam
please,
Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness, and thank you for the time today. And I just want to point out that the Commitment Act hasn't substantially been changed since before I came to NAMI, so it's 19 years. And so a lot has happened in those 19 years that we need to reflect. On page one, under section one, we expanded the definition of community-based treatment program to include all the types of different community programs that now exist in Minnesota. On section two, page one, we changed the definition of examiner to include all mental health professionals for the purpose of placing a 72-hour hold on someone. I want to point out that we kept the court examiner, the current psychologist physician, clinical nurse specialist, the same. We didn't change that, but we're going to call them court examiners instead of examiners. In section five on page two, we added under health officer, we again expanded it to all mental health professionals, and we included mental health practitioners who are on a mental health crisis team, and then we deleted some references that didn't make sense, like pre-petition screeners who aren't out in the community. On section six on page three, we a little bit more clearly defined an interested person. They have to have a specific interest, and it was a little too broad for us, so we changed that. On section seven on page three, we just kind of made it more people first language because it made it like, well, people with mental illness all get committed, which they don't. So we just kind of changed that reference, and that gets changed then throughout the bill. On section eight on page four, we included deputy sheriffs. Section 9, just a minor change. Section 10 on page 4, we don't have regional treatment centers anymore, so we're changing it back to state-operated services, which more accurately reflects what we have in our state. On section 11 on page 5, we define treatment facility to include all our current options, such as intensive residential treatment services and, of course, community hospitals. On section 12, 13, 14, those are all just minor wording changes reflecting the different, again, types of definitions that we've now added. On section 15 on page 5, we've defined psychotropic medication. I want to point out that we, it's kind of like once you get a hearing, then everyone comes forward. And so there's a little problem there that we are going to be working on fixing tomorrow. What we wanted to do was to make sure that under a Jarvis order for involuntary treatment, that we're not just doing neuroleptics, but also doing psychotropics. So people are getting the appropriate medication, but there's some other implications by changing the word all the way throughout. So just know we have to change that, but the intent is still there. On page 5, 6, and 7, section 16 to 20, those again are just minor wording changes to include programs, treatment facilities, and state operated where important, where appropriate. On line 7.15, we moved a reference to a repealed rule. On page 7, on section 21, again, just wording changes, and we added in the importance of looking at a power of attorney or healthcare directives. On line 8.11, we clarified when the head of a treatment facility or state-operated program can give consent in an emergency situation. We just want to make sure that they couldn't locate the person in sufficient time to address the emergency. On page 8, section 22, we updated the language around ECT and, again, expanding to include psychotropic medications. On page 8 on section 23, we added health care directive or psychiatric directive for consent for treatment. Section 24 on page 10, we just kind of put in the treatment review timelines that would be according to the license. Before, it was really all state operated, so it didn't make sense, and now it'll be according to their license. On page 11 on section 26, we just added some other additional professional organizations that should be consulted when we're looking at inpatient admission standards. On section 27 on page 12, we added healthcare directives and made minor wording changes. On page 13 on section 28, again, minor wording changes, but clarifying that we're only talking about legal holidays, not other types of holidays. On page 14 to 15, this is section 29. This is a big deal for NAMI. I can't tell you the number of times I get phone calls from a family member who says, my son has schizophrenia. I can see that they're decompensating, and there's absolutely nothing that they can do until they are a danger to themselves or others. And so we want to try a voluntary engagement approach. And so if you're an adult, so it's not for children, if you're an adult and you're exhibiting signs of a serious mental illness, such as delusions or hallucinations, you have a history of not adhering to treatment, or the person is exhibiting symptoms that might lead to a hospitalization, jail, or court-ordered treatment, you would be eligible for this. A family could call the screening team in the county. The county would make sure that they met those qualifications, and then they could send out an engagement team. And that team would try to really engage that person in voluntary treatment. They'd make sure that they have housing, do they have food, really look at it holistically. They couldn't, you know, use coercion or anything like that. Maybe they need health insurance as well. And they could do this for up to 90 days. By the end of 90 days, either they're in treatment voluntarily or they're going to meet the commitment standard. But we want, again, try to get in earlier. People who could do this could be a crisis team when they're not on a call, could be a certified peer specialist, a homeless outreach worker, or someone from a community staff. We did repeal the early intervention law that's currently in statute because no one's really using it. What attorneys have told us is that by the time they get through that, they meet the regular commitment standard, and so they're not using it. And so why have something in statute that no one is using? But we're actually really excited about this piece because I think we could provide early intervention and really help a lot of people and deter them from getting committed. On page 15 under section 30, we updated some language. We clarified and tried to do the correct citations. We moved some language to another section. Page 16, section 31, we just updated the language. Section 32, children's collaboratives haven't been involved. We don't know why they were mentioned in the statute, so we're deleting them. Page 17 and section 33, health plans already have to cover court-ordered treatment. The additional language didn't seem like it was needed. And didn't really kind of make sense, so we deleted that. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Kerwin.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm John Kerwin, an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I was a participant on the task force. And so I'm going to pick up where Ms. Abderholden left off, which is with Section 34 of the bill, beginning on page 17, and it deals with hold orders. Both transport orders where police officers or health officers pick up a person who is exhibiting a mental health crisis or a chemical dependency crisis and bring them to a hospital. And then once they're at a hospital or treatment facility, what's called a 72-hour hold. So this section deals with both of those. The provision in current law at 253B05 has been very confusing for police officers and hospitals who are the primary actors who have to implement it. And so we undertook to rewrite and reorganize that section while maintaining most of the content. And so I really won't be describing the things that we haven't changed, even though it's reorganized. One thing that we changed slightly at line 17.26 and 17.30
is that the statute described the standard for a police officer or health officer to take a person to a hospital as being in part if the person was in danger of injuring himself. Some police officers thought that required affirmative acts to injure rather than just failing to meet the person's needs. And so we substituted the word harming for injuring and hoping that with training that that will make a difference. There's also clarification made so that if a health officer determines that the standard is met, that would be sufficient authority for a police officer then to take the person to a hospital without the police officer having to make a separate evaluation and determination. And we also said that the police officer could bring a person to a hospital based on a determination in a statement by an examiner who could include someone like a community psychiatrist, for example, who would say this person needs to be brought to a hospital for an evaluation. We provided in the bill, and this is at line 18.20, that the police officer or health officer needn't personally transport the person, but they could also use a medical or mental health transportation provider to do it. There have been questions about the duration of the transport hold under the current statute. How long does that continue once the person gets to the hospital? And so we specifically provided, beginning at line 20.1, that the hospital has to make its own determination as soon as possible, but at latest within 12 hours after the person arrives at the hospital. There were also questions about when a 72-hour hold period that the hospital might impose on the person, when that begins. The current statute says it begins the person can be held for 72 hours after admission. But sometimes a person isn't really admitted to a hospital at the time the hold is placed. They may sit in an emergency room for more than a day sometimes. And so we said the 72-hour begins when the hold is first placed on the person, which seems to make sense. And finally, we put a provision in the bill at line 20.29 that says that if someone goes to court to try to get their 72-hour hold vacated, that the current statute says that certain people have to be given notice of that. We added a provision saying that those people would also be provided a right to object because the statute didn't say that. So going beyond the hold order section, I'll then jump to pages 21 and 22 of the bill, sections 35 to 37. Those sections really involve only technical changes, and so I won't explain those further. Sections 38 through 45 of the bill, beginning on page 22, make a number of changes to the civil commitment procedures that apply before the civil commitment hearing. On line 22.29, concerning pre-petition screening, the bill says that if possible, interviews with the proposed patient should be done in person rather than by telephone. It also says, it clarifies the information that should be obtained from the patient's health plan. It provides that notice of the pre-petition screening decision have to be provided to certain persons who would be listed in the pre-petition screening report, including family members, for example. Throughout, in this section and throughout the bill, the word treating physician or physician is often changed to medical practitioner. And so an example of that is on line 25.20, but it will occur other places throughout the bill that I won't comment on. And that's to recognize the fact that we now have many kinds of medical practitioners who are doing the functions that 20 and 40 years ago when this bill was enacted were done simply by physicians. And so people like nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. At line 26.8 to 26.12, it clarifies which county conducts pre-petition screening when a person is found incompetent to stand trial in a criminal case. There's a provision beginning at line 27.23 that says that if the county where the commitment case is proposes to change venue to a different county, that other county should receive notice and an opportunity to respond before it received transfer of the case. Sections 46 through 49 on pages 29 and 30, I think, only contain technical changes. sections 50 through 53 on pages 31 through 33 talk about the decision and the order on the commitment petition. And one provision provides that the court should look at a broader range of alternatives, including assertive community treatment or ACT teams. The bill also has a provision beginning at line 31.11 that would specifically authorize what we call dual commitments, where the court orders that the person is committed to both a community hospital and to a Department of Human Services facility in case the community placement doesn't work out. Some counties have used that, but courts in other counties haven't allowed it. This provision would specifically authorize those dual commitments. Beginning at line 32.4, there's a change to a limitation on commitment contained in the current statute. There was a statutory change almost 20 years ago that allowed a person with mental illness to be committed if they were found to be unable to meet their basic needs, even if they hadn't yet failed to meet them. But there was a limitation put on that provision couldn't be used to place a person in a state facility, but only in a community facility. And because of that limitation, and because community facilities won't agree to accept a commitment usually if there's not a backup commitment to the state, that provision was really never used. And so this bill removes that limitation. The bill clarifies that if the commitment petition is dismissed, that the court can order that the person be brought back to their home. It clarifies how commitments are to be reported for purposes of background checks. There's a section of the statute, two sections beginning page 33, and there are sections 54 and 55 of the bill. They concern administration of medications for mental illness. There are several changes here. Many of the changes deal with the change in definition or the defined term from neuroleptic to psychotropic that Ms. Abderholden described, and so I won't comment further on those. At 33.17, the bill adds a power of attorney to the types of advanced directives that might be considered in deciding whether a patient consents to medication. There's a provision that beginning at line 34.6 that says that in certain situations, medications can be continued not only based on the provider's request to a court for authority, but also through that process until the court issues the order, because that was a gap in the statute. It could be continued until the request was made, but not until the order was issued. The bill beginning at line 34.31 clarifies that the presumption that a person is competent to consent to medications is a rebuttable presumption, so evidence can be introduced that the person is not competent. Lines 35.1 through 35.13 clarify how the court analyzes the statutory factors to decide whether a person is competent. There's a provision in the law, one of the factors, that says that the court should consider whether the person is refusing medication based on delusions, and we change that language to symptoms of the person's mental illness so that we get at symptoms other than delusions, like hallucinations, for example. The bill provides significantly that if it's necessary to forcibly administer medications to a non-consenting person, that can only be done by injection and that it can't be done by nasogastric tube, which many people find more objectionable. And the bill provides that if there's an existing Jarvis order and the person ends up in a jail, that the medications can be administered under the Jarvis order in jail if there are qualified medical personnel there to do that. And I think that's the end of the part of the bill that I'm going to cover, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Smith.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm the Public Policy Coordinator for NAMI Minnesota. We'll go through this as quickly as I can, and I assure you we will be going faster. On line 40.3, there is clarifying language around what constitutes harm to self or others. And then we have technical changes up to line 42.7, where redundant language is deleted. On lines 42.14 through 5, we're clarifying that protected transport can be used to transport somebody. On lines 42.31, we say that the court order for commitment is sufficient legal authority to confine and provide treatment to the patient in their current location until they are transferred to the facility or program to which they are committed. And then moving forward, we have more technical changes. On line 44.10, it encourages including a statement from the patient around accepting treatment during the 30-60-90-day paperwork. And then further down there on line 44.26 through 44.29, it states that the commitment does not automatically end if the 30-60-90 paperwork is not filed. We've gotten more than a few calls about paperwork being lost, leading to the abrupt ending of a commitment and putting people in a very vulnerable situation, and so we think this will be a meaningful difference. Section 63 and 64 are more minor wording changes. Going on to section 65, on 45.25, we ensure that any of the treatment programs or facilities receive a copy of the continued commitment. Going on to section 66, on line 46.5, we allow for the continuation of an existing commitment order for up to 14 days to complete the legal process to start a new commitment. On section 67 and 68, these are primarily small wording changes, but we do allow the authority to transport a missing patient. Reports of absence from treatment can be from any program, and clarifying that the patient may be returned to another facility or program willing to accept the patient. In section 69, we have the sections on provisional discharge, line 48.9 through 12. It states that if a patient committed to the commissioner is ready for provisional discharge before placement in a state-operated program, that patient may be provisionally discharged. This could be valuable for folks that are waiting to get into the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. Section 70, only minor wording changes. Going on to section 71 on line 49.8, we clarified that the revocation of provisional discharge can send a patient to more intensive community services. Going on to line 52.7 and 8, this provides that the county agency has the authority to modify or extend a provisional discharge or commitment rather than the head of the facility from which the person was provisionally discharged. In 74, section 74, we clarified that the patient can be sent to the previous program or facility or another one when provisional discharge is revoked. Section 75 allows for more intensive community services for revocation. Section 76, where the patient can go when provisional discharge is revoked, is broader. On line 53.3, we ensure that provisional discharge continues if the court extends or creates a new commitment order, unless the order provides otherwise or an agency revokes the discharge. In section 78, we aspire to make it more seamless when a commitment is extended. And from there, we have more minor wording changes until section 83 on page 56.9, which allows for people other than the patient to offer less restrictive alternatives during a continuation of commitment. The upcoming sections are primarily minor wording changes, and it's really only until section 103 and 104 where we recognize the role of mental health professionals in a treatment plan. At that point, we have minor changes, a deleted reference to the early intervention law that Sue already referenced, and then section 120 moves language from chapter 253B to chapter 253D. And with that, I have finished with my portion.
All right, thank you so much. So, do we have any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's a lot here, and thank you very much to everyone who's worked on this. Rather than ask sort of my specific things, I've worked with Mr. Kerwin in the past. I know he's great. It's good to see you and everything. But I do wonder, has there been anybody working on this kind of from the community of attorneys or who would be representing the patient in these kinds of situations? I just want to sort of get, because some of these things, you know, they're a little bit this is a tough issue. And when you think about somebody's, you know, autonomy versus, you know, their need for treatment, et cetera, it's a very touchy thing. So I just want a little comfort on that line.
Ms. Abdelholden.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. Yes, we had the Hennepin County Commitment Defense Project. Doug McGuire was at the table. And we also made sure that Bill Ward, the public defender, also received a copies of the bill.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions are kind of along the same lines. I'm just wondering, I mean, if you could just sort of talk generally, what sort of due process is provided to patients subject to civil commitment orders? I've heard from some people who just have some kind of general concerns along these lines. Just wondering if there's anything like Miranda warnings for people subject to civil commitment or the right to ask for an attorney.
Ms. Abdelholden.
Madam Chair, I can't answer the Miranda warning, but everyone who goes through civil commitment is appointed an attorney. We have sometimes families say, should we hire one? We say no. The people who are doing this work are usually really, you know, kind of immersed in this particular part of the law. Perhaps I can call a friend with Mr. Kerwin. Can you come up here?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative.
Mr. Kerwin.
Yes, thank you. The in terms of Miranda warnings, there's case law actually that's saying that the right against self-incrimination doesn't apply in the civil commitment process. But at various stages in the civil commitment process, people are informed under the Data Practices Act of what their rights are in terms of sharing information. And so that, for example, when the patient is examined before a commitment hearing by a court examiner, that always begins with an explanation to the patient that they can consult with their attorney, they can stop the examination at any time, they needn't answer any questions or participate, and that if they don't participate, the examiner will write a report just based on the other information. And so, and the patient is represented at every stage of the process. Their attorneys meet with them before they first come to the government center to be examined, and throughout the whole process, they continue to represent them after they're civilly committed. And so there is a very robust right to an attorney and representation.
Thank you, that's helpful. I'm also, I mean, I know this process is, you know, there are a lot of steps set out to it. The procedures are very specific in here, but you know, sometimes errors do occur. I'm just wondering, like, if there is an error, are there any specific remedies that's available for a person who is subject to civil commitment, maybe when they shouldn't have been?
Mr. Kerwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. There are various rights that a person has, including, of course, the right to appeal orders that are issued. But in addition to that, the Commitment Act has a section, it's 253B.17, that says that people can come back to court at any time. Like if a person believes, even if I was appropriately committed, I should no longer be committed because I'm improved, or whatever the change situation might be, the person can bring a motion at any time to come back to court and have the court review that.
Okay, Representative Freiberg. All right. Okay, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, testifiers. There was one part that actually kind of caught me a little bit off guard, and I'm hoping that you can clarify. There was some discussion, and I was trying to match it up to the actual part in statute, and I was having trouble doing that. But you mentioned a part about the section on hold orders, and specifically I heard that the intent of that section was to try and make sure that we clarified for police officers exactly what was intended by the statute. But in that same sentence, I heard reference to something called affirmative acts to injure. And I have to be really honest with you, I don't know what that means. And I assume that an officer would possibly not know what that means. Could someone help me understand what that means and how we've clarified that section to make the language clear so that officers can fully understand the statute and follow it?
Okay. So before you answer that, I just want to just share that we need to be out of this room by 4:15. We have one question from Representative Bonner. We have Representative Robbins who has a question. And then we're going to wrap it up. So please, Mr. Kerwin?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The current law under the hold order statute contains the word at risk of injuring the person's self. And so the problem that the people saw was that some police officers believed that that meant an affirmative act like stabbing or hitting or, you know, pushing or whatever, rather than a person's failing to meet their basic needs. Elsewhere in the Commitment Act, there are provisions that are very specific. For example, as a basis for commitment, that you can civilly commit a person because they have failed or unable to meet their basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. But some police officers were not clear that that kind of harm should also be considered. So when they would visit a person's home and find that the person was malnourished or had no heat on in their house, they weren't injuring themselves, but they were causing harm to themselves.
Okay, one follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That has helped clarify. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Robin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kerwin. I think this is for you. I also was concerned about some of the 72-hour hold language for the police officers. I just wondered, were they part of this process all along? And they feel comfortable, especially with the reporting, that the form that they'll need to fill out to request the 72-hour hold?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we had Andy Skugman from the Chiefs of Police was on. We had about 60 people on our email list, and along with the sheriffs. So they all got copies of all of these versions of the bill all along the way.
Okay. I appreciate that. I was privileged to do some ride-alongs with my police officers this fall and actually was there when they initiated a 72-hour hold in my community. And one of the things they told me in the sort of debrief of that situation was that they had worked very hard to create a form for themselves because they felt like the previous forms were not meeting their needs. And I just want to make sure that they put a lot of work into a form that works for them and that these changes may not accommodate. So I just want to make sure that they're being accommodated. Thank you.
Okay. Last question, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I've been on this journey with Sue for 3 years now, right? And I've heard some really tragic stories about being able to help somebody and not being able to address it, partly because of the laws and partly because of the needing for updating. And I know this was a huge slog, and it's probably not perfect. We've talked about that. But to try and help people, families, those who are really struggling with mental health, to be able to get them the help they need and get them back on the path to be successful. And so I want to just say thank you. I think this is a good progress. I know it was tough. And I should say I really appreciate always being emailed. I didn't make many meetings, or I don't think I made any, but I always got all of the correspondence about what was going on in the discovery, and there is a lot of people that were having input, and I know you went back and forth quite a bit because this is a very difficult subject and concerning taking care of just citizens in general. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So there being no further discussion, Representative Edison. Renews her motion that House File 2898, as amended, goes to be the A20-0600, and the A1 amendment is recommended for a re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
Madam Chair, Public Safety, I believe, is where it's going next.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that's okay. Right. So the clone bill.
So it would be going to Judiciary. So, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion moves and...
I know.
Okay. Oh, just for you guys to remind you that we will not be meeting next Tuesday. It's caucuses. Yep. Right. So our next hearing is on Wednesday, February 26th, right here in room 200. Thank you. We are adjourned.